Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good day, everybody. We want to welcome you to this week's edition of Here's to Your Health. I'm your co-host, Dr. Ron Epley, and with me, as usual, is...
your other co-host, Dr. Shane Goforth. So remember, this is a call-in show, so we want to encourage everybody to give us a call. And that number is 347-989-8722. So give us a call, and we'll get you on the air with us.
So I got a couple things I wanted to start off with today. As I was looking back at... I love reading some books like Skeptic Magazine and Skeptical Inquirer and stuff like that, because I like to see what some of the skeptics have to say, because it's really funny. They have their own almost religious-like belief that once one of them believes something, they all have to believe it, even though I think they're wrong, right?
Right.
But they're interesting. So let me tell you this one. This one's about homeopathic remedies and the marketing of homeopathic stuff. Now, this is way back in 2017, but I just found a magazine sitting in my house that I hadn't read. It slipped away somewhere. But these people are pro-vaccination, because in their newest magazine, the 2018 edition, they're talking about their pro-vaccine and their whole thing. But let me tell you within their magazine about homeopathy, and this cracked me up, okay? I'll quote in the middle of the paragraph. First, most homeopathic products are used for self-limiting conditions such as colds or the flu.
Self-limiting condition, yep.
The cold or the flu. Almost right. All patients eventually recover whether or not they take anything. Okay, so did you hear that, Dr. Goforth?
I did.
The flu is a self-limiting condition.
Right.
The people, most people recover. So why are they pro-vaccine and good all over the case of people that don't want to vaccinate for the flu?
Right. Exactly. It's self-limiting. Why do it? Why bother? No. We got to do it. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I know. So this is the absurdity about people, even scientific people or even skeptical people or everything, is they get caught up in their own BS at times. And the reality is I agree with them 100% about homeopathy. 100%.
Right.
I don't think it's a waste of money for people, because the placebo effect is pretty powerful. And if you think it might help you, God forbid, who am I to say, don't take it, that stuff won't work, you're just wasting your money. Go take a real drug, right?
Right. Yep.
So I don't prescribe homeopathic remedies. Actually, I take it back. There is one product that I used over the years that's homeopathic that I have people that come back over and over that want it because they think it works, and so I provide it for them. But I share their skepticism in homeopathy, but I don't share their love of vaccines, because they're for self-limiting conditions such as the cold or flu. Almost all patients eventually recover whether or not they take anything.
Right. I know, that's hysterical.
So if you have that attitude, why take vitamin C for the cold?
Right. Or anything else, echinacea or anything. Why do any of that?
Why do anything, right? Why take a drug for it? It's just going to get better on its own.
Yep. Why get vaccine
for it? You sprained your ankle and your knee hurts, or your ankle hurts, so why do anything about it at all? It's just going to be self-limiting. It'll eventually get better.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that just cracks
pretty
me
absurd,
up.
Pretty absurd, yeah.
I know.
It's too funny.
I know. I know. It cracks me up sometimes how they do that. So I bought the magazine this month because the front page, it says the war on science and knowledge, anti-intellectualism in today's America. And they almost exclusively attack people that are conservative beliefs about how we're unscientific.
Right.
Yet there is one article in there that I was reading that actually went on showing both sides, how both, like the alt, they call it the alt-left, and they talk about the alt-right, how they both really get, they go off on stupidity, which I agree with them 100%.
Yep.
Which is pretty nice. And then they got an article, which I haven't read this yet. It's just on my desk. They're talking about the drug therapy hype and the misuse of data. So, yeah, and they 21 reasons. Oh, and again, let's see. There's an article that says 21 reasons Noah's worldwide flood never happened. And I usually look for one sentence in there, whatever they try to say, to knock down
right.
their whole hypothesis. And I found one in here. I just want to read you this. This just cracks me up. It says, nests of dinosaur eggs are found in several places around the world, and it is illogical that dinosaurs could have had enough time to create those nests and lay their eggs while they were fleeing from the rising waters to reach higher ground.
Right.
Well, the Great Flood happened many millennia after dinosaurs
right.
roamed the earth.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, it's like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And it couldn't have been, let's say, the time of year, you know, the spring when love is in the air and all of a sudden everybody's nesting.
Right.
And there's nests everywhere. I mean, my parents had a farm, right? And here's
right.
what happened. Duck and geese and everything, they'd lay multiple nests all over the place. Some of them would be abandoned. And other ones they would sit on, but they would have multiple nests everywhere, so we'd have to go out there all the time and find their nests.
Right. Because that's what they do.
That's what
they
do.
Get along.
I know.
That's so funny.
I know. There's more in that article that's just absurd about how they try to discount Noah's flood. Now, I'm not saying Noah's flood existed or didn't exist. I'm just saying sometimes they try to prove something one way, and it's pretty absurd how they try to prove it.
Yeah, that's right. Because, I mean, even if you get like, okay, let's just for a minute assume that man walked the earth with dinosaurs. We're just gonna go there and say, okay, that's true, which I don't think it is. Anyway, so if that's true, and they're talking about these dinosaur eggs during the Noah's Ark time, the big flood that happened at the time after the dinosaurs became extinct, because how long were we on the planet Earth before we started using tools and developing technology like ships or large
yeah,
boats in this case?
And the funny part is that I'm not a science disbeliever or denier or anything. And,
right.
you know, you kind of want to go, you want to believe in evolution, because I kind of do a little bit, because there are changes that go on. But I also believe in creationism. And either one, there's evidence that they both existed at the same time. And yet one side wants to say one thing and the other side wants to say the other. So, you know,
right.
so some of the religious people say the Earth has only been around for 10,000 years. But others say, oh, no. That's just a nut job to think that. Well, it's been around for a lot longer. And so then the evolutionary people, they want to take the religious thing and get absurd about it by, well, dinosaurs existed. Therefore, if you believe the planet was only there for 10,000 years, then dinosaurs walked 10,000 years ago, even though we have
right.
scientific evidence that says it was 70 million years ago. So was the flood
right.
70 million years ago? Or 10,000 years ago.
Right.
It cracks me up. Anyway, let's get into the healthcare song. Report, opioid drugs dragged 1 million Americans out of the workforce. Okay, so we're talking about how opioids have killed about 115 people every day. But we forgot
right.
how many millions of people are affected by it, even though they're not dead yet. Says almost 1 million prime-age Americans were dragged out of the 2015 labor force by Chinese-supplied fentanyl, Mexican heroin, and U.S.-made prescription opioid drugs, says a report by the American Action Forum, a Business First advocacy group. That's a lot
wow.
of people dragged out of the workforce.
Got it.
So if they're not working, they're not paying
right.
taxes.
That's right.
And if they're not paying taxes, they're very likely to be the recipient of tax dollars.
Right. It's a huge burden on the tax system.
Oh, my God. No kidding. and the healthcare system and everything.
Yep.
Okay,
wow.
So here's something that we talked about before when it comes to illegal immigration. It says right here, 69% of U.S. tuberculosis cases in 2017 were diagnosed in foreign-born residents.
Really? Well, there you go. That can't be good.
No, and that's what I remember distinctly talking to you about that on the radio.
Yeah, we did too.
We were talking about, that we have screening mechanisms. People have to be up on their shots and everything else before they can get a visa to come here. And, we would never allow people with active tuberculosis cases unless we had a method to prevent them from spreading the disease to other people, right?
Right.
So by them coming over illegally and they bring their diseases, they begin to spread this among other people like crazy. And it's just a burden on our system, and these people can be treated before they come over here.
Right. Yep. Scary stuff.
Yeah, I know. Let's see. I got a whole bunch of stuff here. Let's see. Study reveals lack of self-awareness among doctors when prescribing opioids. Okay. It says emergency department physicians underestimated how often they prescribed opioids, but prescriptions decreased after they saw their actual data.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting enough. They're just kind of mindlessly doing it, you know? Like people sit
in front
of the TV
and
mindlessly eat stuff, you know?
Yep.
Which I think that goes back to a lot of what we've talked about with that profession before, too, in the fact that they, with the lack of sleep that they get, you know, because they're on call for 24 hours or whatever, and so they get, you know, little sleep, and they're constantly having to make these decisions and do stuff. So, I mean, why it would become easy as just like, okay, you're in pain, here's some opioid drugs, thanks, you know, have a good day, whatever, you know.
Yeah, that's what they are. They're taught in college, especially for emergency rooms, to go on autopilot.
Yep.
So, you know, and so if they react the same way every time, they're less likely to make mistakes and do stuff. So what happened is they just don't think.
Right.
Which is, just autopilot. We'll just say, they come in and you're in pain, here, take this.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely a problem.
Yeah, but definitely a problem. Let's see. So direct evidence of exposure of pregnant women to herbicide ingredient. The first birth cohort study of its kind has found that 90% of a group of pregnant women in central Indiana had detectable levels of glyphosate, which is Roundup, right? The active ingredient in Roundup, the most heavily used pesticide in the world. Did you hear that, Dr. Goford?
Yeah.
90% of them.
Wow. Crazy stuff.
So when are we going to start cleaning up our crap? When are we going to get the plastics out of the oceans? When are we going to get the pesticides out of our food?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
I mean, the ridiculousness of
that.
Well, the ridiculous of all of this is I don't think I have it in my file here, but as I was getting ready for the radio show, I found that in California, they're starting to crack down on a certain ingredient found in roasting coffee that could cause cancer, even though when you look it up, the science is very unclear on whether it causes any cancer or not. But in California, if there's a single study out there that may implicate it, they're supposed to put a warning label. So now they're going to crack down. They're talking about cracking down on Starbucks by putting a label on their cups saying it causes cancer. And
right.
yet, what about Roundup? What about
yep.
Roundup out there? And 90% of pregnant women in a certain cohort in Indiana.
Right. Actually, I heard something about that on TV, too. I think it was TV. They were talking about that very same thing.
Hmm. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, where they wanted
what?
To have the people to put label on, or they're going to put the warning label on their Starbucks.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they didn't talk about any of the other stuff that we did. Of course.
You know, I'd like to see the science behind warning labels.
Yeah, right.
To see if warning labels actually alters anybody's behavior.
Yeah, I kind of wonder that too, because you know, you see so many so many warning labels, you know, that you kind of start wondering, what good is it? It just becomes white noise.
Yeah, I kind of wonder that. Even like when you see when you're driving down the road and you see a deer crossing sign, do you ever slow down?
No. I
no.
keep driving.
Oh, Dr. Goforth. Oh, my God. Why wouldn't you slow down? It's a warning sign for you to do exactly that, to change your behavior because something bad
no.
might happen. No, I don't
I
either.
Try to
but
pay
I slow down when I see deer.
Yeah, I do slow down when I see deer, too.
Yeah, so I wonder how effective warning labels are, and do they really mean anything, or are they just some sort of political do-gooders think they're doing the world some good by doing this stuff and costing the system a lot of money and causing a lot of...
Yeah, that's a good question.
What good do they do?
Yep.
Oh, here's an interesting study, because I never believed this would be true until I read it. It says encapsulated fruits and vegetable juices are found to improve inflammation, blood lipids, and weight in the obese. So it look this is in Journal of Nutrition and Intermediary Metabolism, and this is a result of a double-blinded, parallel, randomized, placebo-controlled trial in adults. Isn't that interesting? So they found that taking encapsulated fruit and vegetable stuff. Yeah, now I'm going to tell people just putting your fruits and vegetables in an encapsulation isn't, they're not all the same, but,
right.
you know, they had things, let's see, this, I don't think this is done on the company called Juice Plus. I don't see it, anything related to that in here, but I remember when that was a big deal quite a few years ago, people were trying to get me to market their Juice Plus and all this, and I just couldn't see any studies on it. This show did any good, but, you know, here we go.
Right.
Finally. Essential oils prove to be effective treatment for ADHD. That's
nice.
A surprising one to me. Yeah, that's a surprising one to me because I've always been a bit skeptical about, quote-unquote, essential oils, right?
Gosh, you know, me too, but I got to tell you, lately, I've been using some essential oils for my congestion that I've had, my constant nasal congestion. And
mm-hmm.
really seems to help me sleep because
mm-hmm.
I can breathe easier. I don't know. It's just I know that's totally anecdotal, but I'm like, wow, I was impressed.
Well, like I said, I'm only skeptical of the stuff. I'm not anti that. I'm skeptical.
Right.
We use some in our house periodically, like peppermint oil around Christmas time and a few other things. But,
right.
you know, if they don't cause any harm, then why not try them? Because, you know,
right.
what you're doing is you're doing something instead of some drugs that have been proven to be harmful, right?
Right. Right. So I have choices
of
I could take Sudafed. Or I can try this other stuff and to help me breathe easier. Well,
take,
if I take Sudafed, I don't sleep as well.
Yeah.
But I can breathe better, but I can't sleep very good. But with this stuff, I get to sleep better, and I get to breathe better.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Yeah, well, it's kind of – thank you, Tim. Yeah, it is kind of neat, isn't it? When we, But again, I keep my skepticism healthy about all this stuff. I just don't deny most everything. You know, even with vaccinations, is I don't tell people never get vaccinations. You know, use some common sense with what you're doing. So now listen to this. Potatoes, are potatoes good for diabetics? A study finds there's a prebiotic within potatoes that actually reduces insulin resistance.
That's interesting.
So now that doesn't mean go out and eat potatoes and you're going to get the benefit from it. It means there's an ingredient in potatoes that can reduce insulin resistance. And probably when they extract that ingredient and give it to you, it's like a drug or herbal therapy, then you see the benefits from it. But you probably don't see the benefits from a white potato doing that.
Right.
But then again, I'm not totally anti-white potatoes. I'm more anti-grains. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I also wonder what potatoes they're talking about.
Well, I don't know what this is. I couldn't see exactly which one here. They could have been talking about sweet potatoes too, right?
Yeah. Well, because even like, we're talking about like russet potatoes or the gold, the Yukon Gold or reds or purple, whatever, you know? I find that more interesting because some of those potatoes are supposed to be, you know, better for you than others and blah, blah, whatever, you know.
Yeah. I love sweet potatoes. I like them for their taste and I like them for their health benefits. And I like them to help people get away from their sugar cravings and, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And I could use coconut oil on them instead of butter and put a little cinnamon on there, which helps with blood sugar, and they just taste incredibly good. And it's like, oh, my God. So anyway, more than concussions, football players also face increased cardiovascular risks, according to a new study.
Oh, interesting.
The data presented to the American College of Cardiology's 67th annual scientific session revealed that football players develop structural changes in the heart and face an elevated risk of heart rhythm disorders later in life.
Hmm.
Is that incredible or is that incredible?
That is really incredible, yeah.
Football. More evidence to me that I don't think people should be playing football any longer.
Yep. Crazy.
That's bad news. Now, I don't know why they developed a heart arrhythmia problems. I didn't read enough into the details of this study to figure it out but... they may not know it either. They may just know that they found this in the study, and now the next thing to do is kind of maybe try to speculate and figure out why.
Right.
Let's see, what's this one? I'll go over that one later. Short-term lemon honey juice fasting can be an effective way for a healthy individual to reduce body mass index and fat levels in your blood. So this is researchers from, they call it SDM, College of Naturopathy and Yogic Sciences, and a couple of other places teamed up on this. And they published their findings in the Journal of Ayurveda and Integrative Medicine.
Right.
So we're seeing a lot more stuff, Dr. Goforth, with fasting. I found it effective for me to lose some of my 70 pounds that I lost. And but there looks like people are experimenting with different types of fasting, you know, rather than just starving themselves to death. This one, they use some lemon juice and honey as part of their fast, so they wouldn't, you know. And I don't necessarily agree with cutting out calories 100%. You know, people dump a lot of toxins when they do that, and I think sometimes and also people have some blood sugar related issues that if you put them on a fast, their blood sugar crashes. You got to get all that straightened out first before you can do it.
Yep. Yeah, that can get pretty serious pretty quickly.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny, Dr. G, is that, a lot of times when I was younger, I kept thinking a lot of people could do a lot of this nutritional stuff on their own. They could do detoxifications on their own. They could do all of this. But the more I see and the more I experience it, the more I really realize these people need some sort of supervision.
Right.
Because things can not go exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't have to be you got to go to the doctor and pay $250 a visit while they do their exam on you, look at your ear, eyes, nose, and throat while you're doing a colon cleanse or a detox, right?
Right.
However, to have someone at your disposal, if things are not going exactly like you anticipated, or just a little more advice, because not everybody's 100% the same. Some people need to be fine-tuned one way or another, right?
Right.
And I think sometimes it's checking in with the doctor. I mean, even vitamin D testing, according to Alex Vasquez, who's my favorite chiropractor these days, he says that we should be doing, if we're giving people vitamin D, we should be testing some calcium levels because some people have problems with calcium. But I've been given magnesium with it anymore, so I kind of mitigate that calcium-related problem in rare people. So even if people are taking vitamin D, some people start depositing calcium in places, and it gets to be pretty bad. But it's rare. Well, the good news is it's rare. And so,
yeah, that's good.
Yeah, he's an naturopath, chiropractor, and doctor of osteopathy at DO. So he looks at things from a little bit different perspective. So speaking of vitamin D is found to reduce the risk of death for those with heart disease.
Well, we love our vitamin D. Just because
everything. It says, new study from the University of Bergen, I don't know where that's at, shows that sufferers can reduce their risk of death from heart disease by as much as 30%. With the help of vitamin D. The study followed 4,000 cardiovascular disease patients over the course of 12 years. They were 62 years old on average when it began. According to their findings, those who have blood level values of vitamin D in the range of 42 to 100 can enjoy the mortality reducing benefits. Those whose values are higher or lower have a greater risk of succumbing to the disease. Yeah, 42 to 100, which is right close to the range that I want people to be. It's between 50 and 100.
Right.
I like that. Oh, here we go. I knew I had something in here on calcium that I was mentioning. So here's my thing on calcium. Too much low-grade calcium supplementation is linked to increased risk of colon polyps.
Increased calcium leads to colon polyps?
Yep.
All right. So I did hear that right. Okay.
Yeah, in a randomized controlled trial, more than 2,200 people between the ages of 45 and 75 across the country who had previously had polyps removed were studied. The researchers excluded patients who had a family history of colon cancer, inflammatory bowel disease, and let's see, what else? And other serious health problems. They also accounted for factors like weight, diet, gender, and anti-inflammatory drug use. The patients were placed in groups, took 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day, 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day, plus 1,000 units of vitamin D3, calcium plus a placebo, vitamin D plus a placebo, or a placebo-only control group. The participants were given colonoscopies after 3 to 5 years of supplementation. At the end of the treatment phase, and again, another 3 to 5 years later, they found that those who took calcium on its own or in conjunction with vitamin D had a higher likelihood of polyps after 6 to 10 years. In addition, women and smokers had a higher risk when taking calcium, but not when taking vitamin D alone.
Right.
Those effects were not seen in the first follow-up colonoscopies, and these were published in the journal Gut. So again, there you go. Calcium supplementation is not necessarily what we want to do.
Right.
So now remember, the reason I'm bringing this up is because when we were in college, I think that's the number one thing everybody would prescribe for people was calcium. Calcium,
oh, I
calcium,
like it
calcium,
too, yeah.
Calcium.
Everybody needed their calcium. Oh, you got to get those good bones. But, yeah.
Yeah, and then the dairy industry was like, you know, where else, you got to have dairy because where else are you going to get your calcium? You got to use it to build strong bones. And then of course, the estrogen became a factor. We got to give all women estrogen to build them strong bones and prevent osteoporosis and osteopenia, right?
Exactly.
And lying within the background all along was really the fact that we just needed vitamin D. And so, you know, I used to argue, and you've heard me say this to patients before, that, well, why do you need to drink milk? Well, I need the calcium from my milk. Well, where do the cows get the calcium and get in their milk?
Right.
Did they supplement or did they drink milk? No, they got it from grass. Okay, then just eat grass, or metaphorically speaking, greens, right?
Right.
Eat your greens and take vitamin D. Or I would actually prefer people to eat. Yeah, I'd prefer people to eat green leafies and get some sunshine, but, you know,
right.
You know what it's like.
Right. Yep,
especially
they do.
You know, is,
I'm looking
everybody
out there
I ever
today right now, and I'm looking at some dark clouds coming over. I don't know how much sun I'm going to get today at all.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Yeah.
Plus, it was like 40 degrees this morning. A little cold out there.
Yeah, it was even colder than that here. I had to scrape my window because there was ice on there. So it was a little
okay,
chilly.
So here we... Well, I'm going through studies fast. It's only been a half an hour. Anyway, it says, despite studies finding an increases risk... let me start over. Despite studies finding increases risk of cancer from cell phone radiation, the Food and Drug Administration claims they're safe as long as you're not a heavy user.
Oh. So if you're, not to sound biased, but so a heavy user of cell phone, so if you're not a heavy user, you're like a senior citizen? I mean, you see a kid with a cell phone, they are on that thing all the time. I'm thinking more like a teenager, but yeah, so heavy
no,
user.
No, Dr. Goforth, I see patients that come in here with toddlers, 3 years
yeah.
old.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that too. Toddlers
with a cell phone in their hand entertaining.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I've seen it too.
So also, what does the FDA describe as heavy users?
Yeah,
why? Because like you just said. Like you just said 10 years ago, a heavy user has a different connotation than a heavy user today.
Right.
Today, everybody might be a heavy user in comparison because those cell phones are with us everywhere we go, right?
Yep, exactly right.
So I bought a device to put on my phone called an R2L, which turns 70% of the radiation given off by your phone to light. So I do that on purpose because I don't want... I want to kind of reduce my risk.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I put everything on speakerphone, and I usually keep it away from my body so it's not close to me, right?
Right.
So it's kind of funny people that call me that know that, right? And they go, are we on speakerphone? Okay, I'll take you off. So I usually keep them on speakerphone except for, and they need some privacy when they're talking to me. And then I'll stick it next to my head.
Right. Yeah, which still is not a great thing to do, is it?
No, and then the other thing is they don't have any good data yet that I've been able to see on Bluetooth devices, right? So what if you put a Bluetooth device in your ear to speak on a cell phone? Does that cause radiation as well? Well, there's electromagnetic radiation.
Right.
But is it the same kind of radiation that comes off your cell phone?
Very good question. Interesting.
Yeah, well, we'll find out when we see people with ear cancer, right?
Right.
Okay, so here we go. I think this is going to be, when I start my new radio show, like you and I already did it, we did a show on coffee, which was pretty fun. I think the next one I'm going to do is salt. Because I got a new study here in front of me. It says no matter how well you eat,
Too much salt still causes high blood pressure, according to a new study. Okay, now this is the deal, too much salt. We've had to change the definition of what's too much, because everything they were telling us to do before was too low.
Right.
So, and you and I know better than most that too much of anything is bad and too little of anything. It's called toxicity and deficiency. So the right amount of salt is good. The controversy is do we really know what the right amount is?
Yeah, that's the question, huh?
Yeah. Let's see what they said here. Oh, this one they were looking at. It was kind of believed that if you eat a high amount of salt, if you eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, they're going to counteract some of your salt-related problems. In this study, what they did is they measured all that stuff, and what they found is that it doesn't really help.
Right.
Anyway, so salt, I still think it's good for us. I know it's good for us. We just can't be crazy with how much salt we use. And you know, I don't have any problems with people cutting back on, not salt, but cutting back on crappy foods that have a lot of salt in them, right?
Right.
Like, there's nothing wrong with cutting back on potato chips or corn chips because they're terrible for us anyway, right?
Right.
There's nothing wrong with cutting back on McDonald's hamburgers because they're not good for us, not just because they're high in sodium. So just cut back and eat healthier foods and you'll be okay. But I don't see anything wrong with people salting their potatoes, or if they're eating potatoes at dinner, or putting salt in their chicken soup. As long as we just don't unreasonably add salt to it. Oh, yeah, and I'm not a big fan of eating Campbell's cream of sodium soup, right?
Right. Exactly right. No kidding.
So, you know, I don't have any problems with salt per se, but, you know, we have a tendency to eat bad, and cutting back on the bad foods will naturally restrict a little bit of salt.
Right.
Okay, now listen to this. Fasting is becoming pretty fascinating, again, like I alluded to earlier. Here's a new study. It says strict eating and fasting schedule cleans the blood. A study finds it could clear out the proteins that cause Huntington's disease.
Oh, really?
Yeah, isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. Huntington's disease is a progressive genetic, did you hear that? Genetic condition that,
yep.
Okay, that affects the brain and causes involuntary jerking and twitching movements. And emotional problems like depression and irritability, coordination problems, and trouble learning new things and making decisions. The condition is usually diagnosed when someone's in their 30s or 40s, though in rare instances, a juvenile can be diagnosed during childhood or adolescence. The patients generally live no longer than 20 years after they're diagnosed. There's no treatment or cure for it, though there are medications to manage some symptoms like involuntary movements. Now, research from the Center of Molecular Medicine and Therapeutics at the University of British Columbia in Canada discovered that a fasting restricting food intake to only 6 hours in a 24-hour period can potentially help slow down the pace at which the disease progresses.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So, is it truly genetic if the diet has an influence on it?
Right. Or does it just have a genetic component?
Like, literally everything has a genetic component to it, right?
Right. Exactly.
So, you know.
I mean, really.
I mean, yeah. Even viruses have a genetic component because they have genes too, right? So,
right.
But, yeah. But it's, yeah. So here's an interesting headline. It says, turmeric and omega-3s can cure diabetes. But you'll never hear that from your doctor.
No, you won't.
Mm-hmm. So, anyway. I am more and more prescribing people eat turmeric, right? I happened to find at a salvage food place called Canned Food Warehouse. I was over there shopping, and they had these big bags. I mean, they were huge bags of turmeric, and they were like $7.99. And the normal cost of those bags are like $45, $55 in the store. So I bought several bags to stick on the shelf. I've given a few away to a couple of patients who need it. And it's like, wow, this is cool. I used to buy turmeric because I cook a lot of Indian food or Pakistani food, but that has a lot of turmeric in it. And I love cooking with turmeric. In fact, I got most of my dishes are stained yellow because of turmeric. And every once in a while, I get stained my clothes because I spill some on me and it stains it, right? But
right.
I do consume a lot of turmeric myself. But I used to hate the fact that you go to the store and you buy these turmeric in pills, and they cost a lot of money. But if you go to an Indian store and you buy the spice, I used to buy like equivalent to about half a gallon size container from Indian stores for about $11. And that's a lot of turmeric. Whereas if you buy a little tiny spice container at Safeway or Fred Meyer or somewhere like that, it costs you like $11.99 for a little tiny amount, right? So I used
right.
to buy in bulk a big amount in Indian stores. But lately, last few years, more and more people are buying turmeric from those places. Evidently, they listen to me or something, and the prices have gone up.
Right.
And then also, I've read a couple of articles about the safety of some of the ingredients in turmeric that might be coming over from overseas. But I'm not sure about what they are, but I still use a lot of turmeric. And according to this article, if you take turmeric and omega-3s, but the omega-3s they're talking about are fish oil. So if you take turmeric
yes.
and fish oil, you can pretty much cure your diabetes.
Yep, that's right.
It'd be interesting to just get a patient in that's willing to do that. And let's do this. Let's add this to your diet and see what happens. But we need to carefully
yeah, right.
monitor your blood sugar and stuff, right?
Right. Take care of your health, but do these things too. Yeah, it'd be
mm-hmm.
fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be interesting.
So, breaking down diabetes. Researchers have identified 5 types of diabetes that should be treated differently. Did you hear that? They all got to be
yeah.
treated a little bit differently, still the same.
Wow.
Let's see if I can find them. Okay, no, number 1, severe autoimmune diabetes. This is type 1 diabetes and latent autoimmune diabetes in adults fall into this category. The characteristics of this cluster include the onset of diabetes at a young age, reduced insulin production, low metabolic control, and the appearance of glutamic acid, carboxylase, and autoantibodies.
Right.
Okay, so tell me if that sounds correct to you. But that's kind of like your body's immune system attacking a pancreas.
Yeah, right.
Now, I don't know why it would do that, but that's... We'll worry about that for another time, but it's interesting that would be treated different than the other type. Here's another one. Severe insulin deficient diabetes. People in this group are diagnosed by their elevated hemoglobin A1C, moderate insulin resistance, poor insulin secretion, and the highest occurrence of retinopathy out of the other cluster. Third one, severe insulin resistant diabetes. Obesity and severe insulin resistance are the defining characteristics of that subtype. Those considered part of this group were notable for having a greater incidence of kidney damage. Then we got number 4, mild obesity-related diabetes. That says it all of itself. And then the last one, mild age-related diabetes. Nearly 40% of patients were grouped into this category, making it the largest of the 5 subtypes. So guess what I would say? That's what this study says. I would add another type of diabetes. Diabetes type 3, which is
right.
Alzheimer's disease, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, blood sugar is a problem. Need to get people need to start giving a diet under control for that. So let's go back on the vitamin D. I got another study on vitamin D, or another article on vitamin D. Where's all my studies? I got a whole bunch of articles and not as many studies today. Interesting. Vitamin D for multiple sclerosis. A study shows that living in sunnier climates reduces the risk.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, isn't that interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember. Did we talk about this a few years ago? There was a medical doctor in England. He lived in northern England. He was reading studies or participated in some studies on vitamin D. And contrary to what all his colleagues said, he saw that there was a major difference in people's health. So it was so profound to him that he sold his clinic in the north and moved to the south in sunnier climate.
I don't know if we talked about that or
vitamin
not.
D. I don't remember talking about that.
I don't remember either.
It's one of those things. Well, it's one of those things where people like us, you read the science and you see your patients and you see the health differences in people that do it, and you go, okay, I'm going to go ahead and recommend this. And then the rest of science and medicine says, no, you don't need it. It just makes expensive urine, although not really with vitamin D. But you know what I mean. They're skeptical. And then the guy's like, I'm tired of all my skeptical colleagues. I see what I see. I'm moving. And, of course,
right.
It pretty much turns out to be the right thing he did. His health improves. His family's health improves. All his patients' health are better, et cetera, right? The reduce of death is down, just like the statistics showed that they would be, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Oh, here we go. Nutritional supplementation may provide neuroprotective effects against brain trauma. So this is a new study from Texas Christian University. The researchers talked about how specific nutrients and nutraceuticals can affect a wider number of pathways than conventional drugs, and offering a broader treatment approach for mild traumatic brain injury. But this is pretty big, because this is what we've been talking about. What can we do for all these people with brain injury, right?
Right.
Let me see if I can tease out of here what it is. In the study, researchers only identified one human case that which studied the effects of DHA on brain injuries. While the study revealed that DHA reduced head trauma damage, as measured by the serum neurofilament light biomarker, the results cannot be fully inferred because of constraints of the study. So, these people looked into things that can you prevent it, and they didn't find much other than one case.
Right.
But I like the facility anyway, because there's so many other neuroprotective effects in it. So, cell tower radiation confirmed to cause cancer in animals.
Of course.
I guess it's no longer a conspiracy theory, Dr. G.
Right.
So,
Researchers
from the respected Ramazzi Institute have revealed the results of a sweeping lifetime study that involved exposing lab animals to environmental levels of radiation from cell phone towers. Their findings not only supported those of the U.S. National Toxicology Program that linked the radiation to a rare heart cancer in male rats known as schwannoma of the heart, but they also discovered a higher incidence of malignant brain tumors in female rats. Rats of both genders displayed precancerous conditions like Schwann cell hyperplasia. In addition, the exposed rats had lower litter weights, raising particular concerns for children and pregnant women who lived near cell towers.
Interesting.
So, you remember that controversy? It might have been back when we were in college.
Talking about cell towers and cancer rates for people that lived underneath cell phone towers and
right.
all the people
well,
that were
I heard more with the power line, but in college.
Yeah, it was more power lines. You're right. It wasn't cell phone towers because cell phones didn't exist back then.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, here we go on some more stuff that we talk about all the time. A Canadian study finds sugary beverages and energy drinks can disrupt sleep and shorten duration of sleep in adolescents.
So what you're really saying is that their research is as lame as our research. I mean, come on, who doesn't know that? You can take an energy drink before bed and try to get some sleep? I don't think so.
Especially an energy drink that's sugary, too, right?
Right? Yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, I'm glad they did it again.
I know, but, you know, some people won't listen, you know. I get why we got to do some of the absurd studies out there. Because people don't have any common sense, right?
Right.
You know, and then there's also this is one of the things that I learned when I was in college. I had a college professor told me once, he goes, you could tell the maturity of a society by the complexity of the laws. A very mature society doesn't need very many laws because they can make, you know, they're not trying to get out of things when they do something wrong. A very immature society finds loopholes like crazy to try to get out of everything they did. And so then you got to develop all these really highly complex laws to cover every possible situation, even no matter how absurd, because someone's going to find a way to get out of that one.
Right.
So it's the same with health and nutrition. You know, it's like, well, there's nothing out there that says this is bad for me except for a bunch of hicks that live down south. So, I'm just going to keep doing it until the science shows there's something wrong, you know. So you
right.
almost have to prove to them that there's something wrong because they won't listen to anything else.
Right.
Oh, so here we go. This is nasty. That's why I said when we're going to start cleaning up our environment. It says swimming in the ocean off the coast of first world countries is found to increase the risk of illness.
Oh, really?
Yep. The University of, I can't pronounce this, Exeter Medical School and the Center for Ecology and Hydrology collaborated on a massive study that examined the link between sea bathing and various ailments. The study, the first of its kind, has not so good news for sea lovers in the U.S. and other first world countries. Researchers found that sea bathing doubled the risk of acquiring ear ailments.
Hmm.
The incidence of earache specifically rose by a whopping 77%. Gastrointestinal ailments rose by 29%.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. That's in first world countries. That's not somewhere where we don't, yeah. All the pollutants and stuff being thrown out there, right?
Right.
Okay, so you want to hear a DAW study?
Okay, give me another one.
Obesity in preschoolers has increased dramatically, according to new data.
Okay, DAW.
So why do you need the data, like you were alluding to earlier? Why do you need the data when all you have to do is walk outside and go, oh, my God, look at that?
Right. I know, it's funny.
Yeah, I know. Take it from a lot of studies on obesity. Excess body fat in children is a red flag that mustn't be ignored any longer. Children whose body mass index exceeds the standard should start a healthy regimen. Otherwise, the poor kid is at risk for type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol levels, fatty liver disease, gallstone, and a host of other ailments. That's not all. The fat kid is more prone to osteoarthritis,
slipped capital femoral epiphysis when the ball of the hip joint is dislodged from the upper end of the thigh bone. Early puberty, they're at risk for, breathing problems, and iron deficiency. There's also an emotional price, but it takes a pretty heavy toll on them. Other children and schoolmates may tease them, they get bullied. The poor kid may end up crying, or worse, refuse to go to school because of the bullying. He might grow up emotionally, you know, it goes on and on and on.
Right.
So, is it possible, Dr. G, that people are not aware of this?
I suppose it's possible.
Yeah, and not only, well, maybe an individual person is not aware of it, but how about the schools?
Oh, yeah, right. They should be abundantly aware of it, shouldn't they?
Are schools where we have, I'm kind of saying this facetiously, but schools
right.
where we have highly educated teachers,
mm-hmm.
why do they continue to feed them crap at school?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe their high education doesn't include any kind of nutritional classes. Although,
yeah, so
they're out there teaching nutrition to kids.
Yeah. So why aren't they getting them? I mean, this is a lifelong thing. We used to have health classes, and if you remember, health class was kind of a joke, remember?
Yeah.
Is it still a joke?
Probably. Except for now they're doing more sex ed stuff in health class. And apparently the things that they're covering in sex ed is a little bit, is a lot more than what they covered when you and I were in school.
So I'm wondering, when are we going to start teaching our kids the stuff they need to not just make them good students and good citizens, help them be healthier and happier?
Right.
And when is the school going to take a little bit of responsibility for, since they're the number one educators, of beginning to educate our kids rather than a lot of their BS political crap that they want to teach our kids?
Right.
Right. Let's get rid of the politics and start getting into health. Anyway. So speaking of food waste, the biggest loss could be what you choose to put in your mouth. So the new analysis suggests hundreds of millions more could eat from the same resources if we switch to plant-based diets.
Right.
Now I'm not a big fan of what they're saying here. That's why I printed it out. It says researchers have now found a novel way to define the quantity of a second type of wastage. The scientists have called it opportunity food loss, a term inspired by the opportunity cost concept in economics, which refers to the cost of choosing a particular alternative over better options. So what they're trying to say is that we're wasting a lot of resources by eating meat instead of vegetables.
Right.
That what we should be doing is developing artificial proteins out of plant-based animals, and we should only eat the plant-based stuff, even though research shows that we need fish, right?
Right.
We need fish oil. So, well, you know, it's absurd to me, actually.
Yeah, I get that. I agree. It is absurd.
It's totally crazy. So, but, you know, these people, this is not really this is really not a study that showed that this is better. This is just an economic analysis. So we can feed millions more people if we just switch to plant-based because it costs more room and effort to raise animals to eat, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, we know, or at least I know, how absurd a lot of the economic theories are. They're just theories. There's no economic facts involved. You know, it's not like Newton, not like the law of thermodynamics or the law of, you know, some of the scientific laws that have been developed, the law of gravity, right? The economics are not like solid scientific laws. They're all purely theories. There might be a couple of little laws in economics, but a lot of these are just, well, let's theoretically choose to do this, and it looks like it's pretty good. But anyway, hey, guess what?
Oh, really?
We
need
an hour again. It is already. So anyway, so let's call it quits. So that concludes today's show. So until next time, here's to your health.
Thank you.